Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Jonathan Stoller, an associate and certified NBPA agent at IP Agency. It's great to have you here with me today, Jonathan.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, well, just before we get started, could you take some time to introduce yourself, tell us anything interesting that you'd like us to know?
Sure. Yeah, as you said, I'm an associate and agent with IP Agency. I'm also an attorney with another law firm as well, handling primarily sports law, some entertainment and business litigation. I'm new to South Florida, went to law school, Thomas Jefferson in San Diego, went to college at Syracuse, studied sport management, knew I always wanted to go to law school and be in the sports and entertainment area, and that's where I'm at right now.
Okay, well, great. Our topic here today is about an article that you wrote. It's entitled, Creating an Equitable Playing Field, Vital Protections for Male Athletes in Revenue-Generating Sports, who are predominantly African-American. This article was published in the spring 2014 edition of the Arizona State University Sports and Entertainment Law Journal. So, that title, it seems like it covers a lot of things, right? It covers male athletes, revenue generating, you know, race issues. Can you give us a brief overview of what the main issues that you talked about are in this and how you looked at them?
Sure. Well, I had to write an article. I was a sports law fellow in law school and in the Center for Sports Law and Policy there, and we had to write papers for certain classes, and I was in a race and gender and sports law class. And I decided to take on the topic. This was back in 2012, 2013. So this was kind of the discussion of, you know, athletes getting paid and exploited, and the, you know, things that people were proposing were just starting to take effect then. So it was a really hot topic. So I kind of chose to dive into that. And, you know, my research kind of led me to see, even though I kind of already knew on my own, that, you know, primarily football and basketball, the men's basketball, the sports that make a lot of money and kind of fund the whole athletic program at all these colleges and universities are played by predominantly male African-Americans. And while these guys are making the universities that they're playing for millions upon millions of dollars, and the coaches are getting these, you know, astronomical salaries, these guys are going home at night without any food in the refrigerator or don't have enough to pay their electric bill. And, you know, that's just not right. So, you know, my goal was to research kind of the history behind how this all started, the proposals that have been put in place or people have suggested, and what worked for that and what didn't, and then kind of propose what I think would be a good plan. And it's kind of interesting to see a lot that has taken effect from 2012 to now, and a lot of things that I kind of proposed have kind of gotten the wheels turning, which is good to see.
Yeah, no, and this is an issue that's been in the news a lot. I think people are familiar with the O'Bannon case and a lot of these other lawsuits that are brought against the NCAA or something like that to try and find situations that people representing the athletes argue are more equitable. And I think public opinion has shifted pretty greatly over the past couple of years as well, that people start to see, you know, this is exploitation of a student athlete or something like that. Whereas I think a couple of years ago, I think very few people thought that. You know, speaking to those people that don't feel like this is exploitation, how have you seen, you know, throughout the course of history that athletes, particularly male African-American athletes in these revenue-generating sports, how have they been exploited or treated unfairly throughout the history of college sports?
Sure. Well, I mean, it kind of goes back even to the 1920s. You know, there was a desire from the colleges and university of whites not wanting to associate with African-Americans because there was the view that they were inferior. And, you know, I think a good example is back in 1916 at Rutgers, a gentleman by the name of Paul Robeson, who was an All-American on the football team, he was prohibited from playing a game against Washington and Lee College because Washington and Lee threatened not to play the game if Robeson was allowed to participate. And it really came down to money, because Rutgers knew if they didn't play Washington and Lee, they were going to lose money. So they didn't allow him to play. And we kind of even saw that today with the, what's going on at Missouri, where there was so much racial tension with all that had happened there with the student body president and, you know, a swastika being, you know, smeared on a dorm wall. No action had been taken. And then once the football team kind of said, hey, we're not going to play Saturday, I think everyone realized, and when I say everyone, the boosters and the athletic department realized they were going to lose a lot of money that day. So that's when they ended up taking action. So, you know, it's interesting to see that from 1916 to 2015, while a lot has changed, a lot hasn't changed. So, you know, and I think the big thing for me that I found when I did my research is a lot of these guys, if they get hurt, you know, not until recently, if they got hurt, they would lose their scholarship and say, you know, sorry, but we got to fill this spot with somebody who can play. And a lot of these guys come from underprivileged backgrounds, so they don't have the money to afford to play for school, so a lot of them end up dropping out or end up, you know, accumulating a hell of a lot in student loans, which I think a lot of us can relate to.
Right.
But, you know, that was one issue. And then also the other issue was just a lot of these guys come out, you know, we can debate all day on another day how long they should stay in school. But while they're in school, I think it's the university's obligation to provide them a good education. So, you know, I think changing the curriculum to classes that will benefit them and the limited time that they're in school will help them with their, you know, their lives after their playing careers.
Right, yeah. And obviously there's a whole lot of issues there, and we don't have time to cover everything. But yeah, I know I think just about everybody recognizes that there are issues, whether it's these financial ones, that does seem to be a strand throughout the history. That financial issues coming to here, whether it's student athletes not being compensated or not being compensated, you know, with a salary or something like that, or having money for food and things like that. These are all issues that where that's a group that needs that support and is not receiving the support.
I agree.
Okay, so now let's go into a bit of the meat of your paper. And again, like you said, this stuff has changed and is pretty fluid since you wrote your paper. But what are some of the proposals you looked at for resolving these disparities?
Sure. Well, obviously being a law student, I had to look into litigation being an option, which people have definitely taken that as one route. Like you mentioned, Electronics Arts and the Collegiate Licensing Company with their lawsuits over the intellectual property, you know, name, image, and likeness infringement, and ended up being a $40 million settlement. And now it's interesting to see that even the NFL is trying to get in on that as well, with the older players not seeing, you know, quote unquote, their cut from using their name, image, and likeness. So, you know, that's been an option. The problem with litigation, as you know, first, the courts are going to find it on a case by case basis, which makes this inconsistent. It's also very costly and obviously can end up unfavorable if it doesn't work out for your side. So, you know, that's one route, but not the route that I would necessarily recommend. So that's one. The next I saw was just simply the cost of attendance stipend, which I was a huge proponent of, which I'm glad to see the Power Five conferences are, you know, implementing that at most of their schools. And I believe it was the Big Ten that kind of set that off, which, you know, the mid-majors are complaining that creates more of an imbalance. But, you know, I'll give you an interesting statistic. From 1950 to 2005 in football, over 50% of the top eight finishes in the AP poll were accumulated by just 12 different schools. So, you know, I don't think this paying players a stipend is not going to change that reality.
Yeah, exactly. And I do want to make that point really clear, that this is one thing that people bring up all the time. You know, if the Power Five people give money, you know, in this case, it's just a cost of living stipend, but that creates an imbalance. You know, the imbalance is already there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a whole lot of external factors beyond this additional compensation that create this imbalance. And so this idea that it'll be unfairly skewed, you know, I just don't think that carries a lot of water when you consider how skewed it already is.
Sure. Yeah. No, well, I'm glad we're in agreement on that. But not everyone thinks that, because, you know, another proposal I saw were people saying, let's just keep it status quo. You know, there's already a lot of imbalance and it's very class-based, the whole amateur concept. Why change it? You know, these kids are already receiving, they're getting paid, they're getting an education. But going back to my point earlier, what kind of value is the education that they're truly receiving while they're there? You know, and with the cost of attendance stipend, you know, these things are just, it it's just an additional, you know, several hundred to, you know, maybe a couple thousand dollars a year that helps these guys pay for things that, you know, the average college student can pay for or afford, but they can't. So, you know, a good example, the head of the National College Players Association, Ramogi Humo, who's a former UCLA linebacker, he talked about how when he played, when they would go on the road, he would steal toilet paper and soap and shampoo from the hotels. And, you know, he would eat as much, take as much food as he could too when he was at these hotels, because, you know, these guys are big guys. They're not average guys. So they, you know, these 5 or 6 meals that they need to be taking in, they're not getting from the, you know, whatever student meal plan that they have. And having this cost of attendance stipend will, you know, would help kind of balance out, you know, their issues that they're having financially. But I feel like that's good. It's just not enough. So another proposal I looked at that I thought was really good was the California Senate Bill 1525, which they called, they deemed it the Student Athlete Bill of Rights. And it was the Senator Alex Padilla that kind of took this on at the forefront. And he said, I want to provide schools in California with coverage for health care premiums and deductibles, especially for low-income student-athletes and those that have exhausted their eligibility but still want to receive their degree, and those who have sustained injury. So that way they'll have, you know, kind of the guarantee that they're going to get their health insurance paid for and covered, and, you know, they're not going to lose their scholarship. The problem with that bill, while it had good intentions, was it only applied to USC, Stanford, UCLA, and Cal Berkeley, because those were, you know, the bigger schools. And, you know, one of the requirements in the bill was the schools had to make so much money in media revenue. And obviously the smaller schools, like we're talking about, like a Cal State Northridge or UC Davis, they're not going to be able to offer those, you know, types of benefits.
Okay, so there's a fear of creating an imbalance somehow, or at least it being under-inclusive and not including enough athletes.
Exactly. But I feel like, you know, there's not going to be a perfect plan. Like you said it yourself, there's going to always be the mid-majors are going to, you know, complain that the Power Five conferences are going to have that edge. But, you know, when you're there's obviously a difference in the type of players that both these schools are recruiting. And that imbalance is not going to go away. Like I talked about that statistic with since 1950. It's just it is what it is.
OK. And have you seen, since you wrote your article, any other states or, you know, any other organizations putting together a bill of rights like this for student athletes?
You know, I haven't. California, you know, that's where I went to law school. So, and that kind of was big news while I was living there. So that was easy to kind of cover. But I really didn't see any other states specifically implementing things like this. I can talk about later. You know, there were some schools throughout the country that kind of implemented systems that would help the student athletes, but nothing like this student athlete bill.
Okay. So what do you see, you know, going forward? How would you fix this problem?
Well, what my plan was first, I think that you have to include the cost of attendance stipend just to kind of help the financial strains on the kids. And cost of attendance stipend, that term gets thrown around loosely. You know, what that really means and includes are like parking fees, utility bills, clothing, emergency trips home if there, God forbid, there's a funeral or a birth of a family relative, things that the average college student can afford to pay for. But a lot of these student athletes, because of their background, can't. So I think that definitely needs to be included. You know, there's obviously been a lot of talk, too, with a lot of these proposals. What about Title IX? And when the interesting thing about Title IX is a lot of people equate it to it being an issue with, you know, balancing out men and women's sports. It actually was implemented to balance out, you know, on the education side. You know, it was supposed to be, there's going to be no person be excluded from participation or denied benefits under any educational program receiving federal finance. And then it all of a sudden became more of a focal point in athletics. And the ironic thing is, while Title IX has helped solve gender inequity, it's kind of resulted in racial inequity because, for example, football and men's basketball programs accounted for $19.6 million in revenue. Now, these numbers are older when I wrote the paper. That's compared to less than $500,000 from women's basketball programs, which you would, you know, I think we can agree is probably the biggest sport for women's sports. Yet there were 492 more women's programs than men's in Division I. and it's the men's programs that are funding these programs for the women. So it's kind of counterintuitive. So a lot of people say, well, this cost of attendance stipend, is it only going to go to the men's basketball and football players? And my plan was no. I think you need to make sure that every remaining student athlete, you know, whether it's the baseball team, softball team, you know, cross country, whatever, they need to implement a cost of attendance stipend for everyone and have it distributed equally to the remaining student athletes, so there aren't any Title IX or equal protection claims. So that was the one aspect. The next was definitely having guaranteed scholarships, which, again, you're seeing the Power Five conferences implement that, which I'm really happy to see. You know, making sure these guys are taken care of. If they do have a season or career-ending injury, God forbid, they're going to be taken care of while they're in school and have their health insurance paid for and make sure that they don't lose their scholarship so they can get their education. And then the big point that I don't think enough is, this is not talked about enough, is, again, going back to the course load and what they're studying while they're in school. I suggested that having courses required for student athletes include accounting, finance, financial planning, money and banking, you know, presentational speaking, public advocacy, interviewing skills, sports psychology, nutrition. All these classes, you know, are topics that are in areas where a lot of student athletes end up going in their careers when they're done playing. And sadly, a lot of these guys don't even know how to open a checking account. So having, you know, taking these classes will help them with basic skills that they're going to need to know once they're done playing, you know, when they're out of school. So those were kind of the big points that I had for my plan, and I'm glad to see some of them are slowly being implemented, you know, a couple of years later.
Yeah, no, and that's interesting. You know, we're a little limited on time, but I want to go back to two particular things that you talked about. So one was these Title IX issues and distributing the cost of attendance stipends, and you said that your plan, you know, you think it should be distributed to all student athletes, right? And then you talked about this imbalance between the number of programs that exist between men and women's programs. Now, one thing that I know I've heard people say is that if everybody gets these cost of living stipends, that's just too much money, and you know, so maybe some schools have enough revenue that they can deal with it, but a lot of schools are barely breaking even or are even losing money. And so the idea of giving extra money to all student athletes could be a big toll, right? On the economics of a lot of schools. And so that would potentially result in the elimination of even more programs. So what do you have to say about that?
Sure. Well, hopefully you can provide a link to my article, because I have a couple of nice charts in there that kind of show the top 10 or so schools for sources of revenue and also expenses. And so the largest sources of revenue are ticket sales, donations, media rights, and branding. And the largest expenses are coaches' pay, tuition, and marketing. So why I raise those is, it's interesting that people who are making the argument, well, you know, our programs are losing money. You know, if we give out money to everyone, then we're going to be even more in the red. Yet they continue to pay these coaches these astronomical salaries, you know, millions upon millions of dollars. You're seeing, you know, guys going for the pros to college or, you know, vice versa. They're getting these massive, massive contracts. Where is a little piece of that going to go towards the student athletes? And, you know, when I said donations, that goes to boosters. And a lot of these, you know, these boosters, they have so much money that they're putting into, you know, funding these facilities. And that's important, too. But again, I think it comes down to the colleges and universities taking more responsibility and more accountability with taking care of the student athletes that are making their schools millions of dollars. So if they can better allocate the money so that the students are getting a piece of the pie, I really think the people that are at the head of these universities, you know, the reason why they have that role is because they're educated, they've had the experience. So if they use their skills, they can better allocate the money so that it's equally distributed, you know, especially to the people that are making the most of the money.
Okay, yeah, no, that's a great answer. I'll definitely link to your article on the blog post. And then, and that's one thing. Yeah, clearly, if more money is going out to student athletes in the form of these stipends, there's going to be a redistribution of where that money's going. Now, that could mean that there would be less programs. It could also mean that some of these people, like coaches who are making a lot of money, would make less money. And then that's a valid point. It's not necessarily it doesn't have to be there being less programs. you know.
Yeah.
And, right. Is that, am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, it does. And you know, something that another point that people raise is, you know, it's so hard to account for. So that, you know, what my plan was, you know, while the stipend and the scholarship would be guaranteed, they can be accounted for and allocated on an annual basis because, you know, the financial statements are always going to are subject to change from year to year. If a school has a good year, they're going to make more money. If they go 0-12 in a football schedule, they're going to lose money. So as long as it's fair, that's what it comes down to, is fairness and taking care of student athletes who are not in a position of power. They're the ones who are making most of the money for the school. So as long as they get taken care of and treated fairly, I think that's what it comes down to. So if they get $950 as a stipend 1 year and $1,200 another year, obviously they're going to be in favor of $1,200, but at least the $950 is helping them along the way while they're in school.
Well, yeah, and then I've got one more question. I think this is a good one to end on. It's perhaps a little bit outside of the scope of your article, but it was something that you mentioned earlier when you talked about how amateurism, this notion of amateurism, is class-based. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people think of. They think, oh, you know, sports, they should play for the love of the game. You know, the class implications don't appear to most people. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I can give you a quote here. You know, the Drexel University sport management professor, her name's Dr. Ellen Storofsky. I apologize if I'm butchering her name. She said, what college sports did was take that amateur concept, which was so class-based, and broadened and democratized it. But they ultimately still made it favorable to the power elite people who are running colleges and universities, and it's created an exploitative system. So I think that goes back to my point earlier, in that this goes back to, you know, there was segregation and discrimination back in like the early 1900s, and a lot of it comes from the good old boy system of hiring and you know, the people who are at the heads. And head coaching positions are predominantly white. You know, back in when I wrote this article a few years ago, 89% of head coaches are white. So that leaves a very small percentage for minorities, all minorities, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans. And the same goes for athletic directors. It's predominantly Caucasian. So the fact that that exists at not only, you know, the student level, but even at those who are supposed to be a power position of authority for the students while they're playing, that's what kind of makes this class-based system all the way from the beginning to the end. And that's where I think it needs to change. And that's why I advocated big on the educational side of, while they're in school, give them courses that they can really use in their life so they have good life skills going forward, and they can give them a better opportunity for a better job. Because, you know, you and I both know that far a majority of these student athletes in college are not going to go on to play professionally. So they need to be, you know, ready for the real world and be able to get a job and be a good member of society and actually contribute and know how to open a checking account, which I laugh when I say that. But honestly, a lot of time when I did my research, it was staggering to see that a lot of these guys didn't know how to open a checking account. So, you know, I think that's just kind of the way that it's been going. It's been a problem for the last 100 years. But like I said, it's nice to see a lot of the points that I had proposed kind of getting implemented slowly but surely over the last couple of years.
Okay, well, great. Yeah, no, I think we'll see a lot more change in this in the next couple of years, but yeah, it's good to have this discussion now and look forward to the future of seeing this change and how it all ends up working out.
Yeah, for sure. And I agree. I think that we have seen a shift in the power from the NCAA to the Power Five conferences. I think the NCAA landscape has already changed from when I wrote this paper to now in the last, you know, 2.5 to 3 years. And I think we're going to see a bigger shift as well. And the NCAA is going to be vastly different in the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay. Well, yeah, thanks for coming to speak with us today. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we end?
No, I appreciate the time. I think it's a great podcast. You know, definitely, you know, good discussions on sports and law and business. If you're interested, I share a lot of sports law and sports business and entertainment business articles on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter at JMStaller3. Appreciate that. But no, I appreciate the time, Peter.
Yeah, no, and I'll put a link to your Twitter account on the blog as well. So yeah, if you're interested, look up Jonathan. He's a great Twitter follow and has a lot of interesting things to say and talk about. So, thanks for coming on the Sports Law Biz podcast.
Thanks for the time, Peter.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. this podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is at Lieb Montoya in both places. That's at L-I-B Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott. And you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, at PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, at SportsLawBiz, or through email at SportsLawBizBlog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. Looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.